I'm not sure there are so many representatives, PI representatives in the room, but I just wanted to say that I really enjoy my time in PI. It's a very special opportunity for me to be here and to enjoy all the interaction with visitors, staff members, students. So this is really good. So the talk is very specific, but what I want to show you is that this is actually something I work for 15 years, but this covers a lot of physics, and it's very broad, and I will try to show you, and it's probably good for the people who are, I mean, the youngest people in the room, I'll try to show you that some cases of research are leading to very interesting path, but not necessarily the best result you expect. But this is research, and this is what we expect, right? So what I want to show you is how a very naive question initially led me to explore a very wide range of phenomenology. So this is all related about dark matter. And I know that many of you have listened to talks about dark matter, but it's difficult for me to start without going through the basics. So I will try to go fast, but I will try to give you the important information to understand the rest of the talk. If I go too fast or if there are issues, please ask me. I'm very happy to stop. For those who do not know what is dark matter, you can consider it for now as an invisible substance which dominates the matter content of the universe, and we don't know what it is, and that's essentially why so many people work on the subject. What we do know, and we do know a lot, even though we've never seen what is, what dark matter is made of, we know that it's everywhere. It's if you look at a cluster of galaxies, it's there. If you look, so cluster would be here. If you look at a spiral galaxy, it's there. If you look at elliptical galaxies, it's also there. And what is extremely strange is that it's somehow organized. I think it makes a noise every time I click the thing. But yeah. So now you know when you have to look. So what is very, very strange is that it does organize under the form of filaments. So in between clusters of galaxies, in between galaxies, you see some structure which are extended, which looks like filaments, and they're actually made of dark matter. Now I have a little film to show you what we observe. And this is mostly, sorry.
Are we sure that all these experimental issues have the same answer? That is the same phenomenon?
We know, so you could try to have different type of dark matter, but you know that there is this kind of, there is more invisible matter than luminous matter. That is a fairly robust statement at all scales, which is the main point. Now you could go in detail and say that indeed it's different phenomena every time, and I will show you the information we have, which helps us to actually connect all the bits that we have. So this is this is basically a film, a movie, which has been assembled from the data from SDSS. And all you see, I hope you can see because there's a lot of light, but you can see lots of galaxies basically all around. And in fact, you do guess the filaments there. So what we know is that there are lots of galaxies, but everywhere you have a galaxy, you have dark matter. So you have a lot of dark matter. Now inside a galaxy, you also have dark matter, but you also have lumps of dark matter. So there is also a structure inside the galaxies themselves, in the what we call the halo. There are also structures, little galaxies, which contain a lot of dark matter. So it's everywhere, it's organized, and it's there very early on in the early universe. Can you hear me at the back? Because it's really hard. Okay, because I don't have a microphone. I have this thing which records, but I'll try. The first evidence, robust evidence. Ah, now it works. Thank you. I had to say, no, not anymore. Okay. The first evidence that people mention for the existence of dark matter, for the first proof, if you want, start in the 30s, but the one that people really accept started actually in the 70s. And we had Vera Rubin and Ford, who basically were trying to measure the rotation curves of galaxies. Now we knew, We knew that galaxies were were rotating since more than 100 years, but the question is, if you look at stars in the galaxy, what is their rotation velocity? Now, those people were the first to try to do the plot, but actually what they were really measuring is the visible matter, so visible stars. I mean, basically they used what they saw in order to make this plot. People actually usually say that Vera Rubin discovered dark matter, but it's not really true, because what she was really plotting is a visible matter. But what she could see is that actually there must be something else than visible matter. And this was really proven with a set of people a few years later, when they actually used the hydrogen, the 21 centimeter, to obtain the rotation curves, the bits which is here, which is basically extended very far from the galactic center. Now, the one who collected all the data and really showed, I think, in my opinion, that there must be dark matter in galaxies is Boltzmann, Albert Boltzmann, and he's the one who really showed that there is some sort of universality. Now, why is this important? Well, because of the following. Take a galaxy, and in this case, I took a galaxy, a galactic disk, which has an extension of 20 kiloparsec, and then you look at the velocity, the rotation velocity of this galaxy. And you will see that at the center, basically you have a certain velocity, but around, in that case, around 8 kiloparsec, you have almost a peak of a velocity. And then if you go a little bit further, for example, at 20 kiloparsec, which is the age of a disk, then you have exactly the same velocity as in the center of a galaxy. So what we're saying here is that if you have a star which is very close to the center, and if you take a star which is very far from the center, which is at the end of a spiral arm, they both have the same velocity. In terms of Newtonian physics, that's not possible because you have dissipation. If you take a star in the arm of a galaxy, you would expect it to rotate with a smaller velocity as a star very close to the center. So from there, you could say, well, if you continue, then you're able to map velocity while you don't have any more matter. So you need a dark matter. You need an invisible substance which makes the galaxy rotate, because you don't have any more visible light. Now, what is amazing here is that now you can say, well, the difference between the theoretical prediction based on ordinary matter and visible light is here. That's a prediction you have based on dark matter, the difference must be the dark matter. So what you get is basically you can quantify the amount of dark matter, and you can either say that you have dark matter, or you can actually say that you have a modification of gravity. People try both. At the moment, the consensus is more towards the fact that you have some invisible matter. So when you use this expression, you make a mistake on the mass. You actually take the luminous mass, but you should have taken the mass, luminous mass, plus the invisible mass. Now, this is a consensus at the moment. This can change, and maybe it will change, and you will probably understand why. The other thing I wanted to say is that every stars have basically, or every particle inside this structure have a velocity which is essentially 10 to minus 3 c. So we're talking about non-relativistic objects. Any objects located here is basically non-relativistic. But what you look is, because you have this structure here where you say that you have some invisible matter far away from the galactic center, you're concluding that you have a following picture. You have in the center, you have a visible substance, so that's a galaxy, that's a galactic disk, and all around you have some kind of dark matter which constitute what we call a halo. And the reason why I mention this is that this is one part of the dark matter searches that we spend a lot of time on. So if I go back to just the question of a galaxy and just ask, sorry.
Just to question your consensus for a minute, can you go back to the... So you see characteristically that the rotation curve goes flat.
Yes.
From the point of view of the dark matter hypothesis, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that it's not explained. That is why the halo distribution should fill in exactly right relative to the Triana distribution, that the rotation curve is flat.
So it
seems like there's more to explain.
Yeah, so absolutely. So this is basically a first evidence. It doesn't mean that this is the absolute answer, indeed. I agree. The thing is, what is a bit, I will come back to that. I will say why I believe this may be some new matter which is invisible in a second, actually, so, or in a few seconds. So if you buy my hypothesis, not necessarily Lee's hypothesis, but if you buy my hypothesis, you assume that there is some dark matter in the galactic halo. And if you think matter, then it's very likely that you would basically assimilate this to new particles. So you're basically saying that there could be new particles surrounding the whole galactic disk. But before you accept this statement, and in fact you should never accept it because we don't know if it's true, but before you actually think about this, you may actually consider another option, which is maybe the halo is just made of bionic matter, and maybe it's just made of compact objects. So there were two experiments in the 90s looking for those massive halo compact objects. Unfortunately, the name of the experiments is very unfortunate, Eros and Macho. So you will appreciate the sense of humor in the community. I'm sure this was true in the 90s. I think now it wouldn't be approved anymore. But what you see is that basically they were saying, okay, if the galactic halo is made of compact objects, we can look for them. And they look for them using some lensing technique, which are called microlensing, but it doesn't matter. What they were looking for is very small objects, which are, in fact, of the same type as the planets in the solar system. So they were looking for, so I hope you see, but they were looking for objects in the range of 10 to minus 8 to 10 to minus 3, 10 to minus 2, depends a bit on the model. But essentially, they were looking for Pluto, Jupiter, and Earth, if you want. Now, they've been very successful. They've been fantastic. They got results, and the results they got is that if this is the right explanation, then you should get 100%, right? But what they get is they couldn't find any of them. I mean, they put a limit, and what they found is that if those objects are present, then their fraction is less than 10%. So you can forget about it. Maybe they exist, but they're not the dark matter. They're not the galactic dark matter. You need to have something else. And the both experiments were actually competing. One is European, the other one is American. They were fiercely competing, so you can be sure that they really tried their best to make a discovery, but they really found the same. So in other words, this is not the right explanation in this range of mass. But strangely enough, this hypothesis got revived very recently for the following reason. LIGO discovered primordial black holes at 30 solar masses, and that's exactly a compact object. So in this case, you look at the plot, which is here, you see that's the microlensing, so Eros and Macho limits, but the discovery by LIGO is just here in the hole between the white boundaries and basically the microlensing limits. So in principle, you think, well, maybe you can have primordial black holes as dark matter. But it is excluded by the CMB limit, and I will explain what CMB is later on, but they are excluded in principle by the fact that we have a relic, photons coming from the Big Bang, coming to us, and we can describe that very well. And if the primordial black holes were there, they would actually change the physics of this background, and we would see it. So this was actually in 2007, but now with the LIGO discovery, a lot of people say, entertain the idea that maybe there was a mistake in this plot. And as a matter of fact, some people, notably Kamionkowski, found a possible mistake, which basically consists in saying that the estimates of the impact of the primordial black holes on the cosmological microwave background has been overestimated. And in reality, the limits may not be as strong, as stringent as what was in this plot. So what they say is that this range in between 1 to 100 solar masses is actually okay. You could have that, which means that then you can have a distribution of primordial black holes in that mass range, and you can do the 100% of dark matter that you're looking for. Now, if they're right, then we solve a problem. Okay, but we need to make sure they're right, and so you can propose. You can try to look for this, and we have one experiment, in fact two now, which were not dedicated to that kind of search, but which can be used to look for primordial black holes. And the first one is TEIA. I was actually the PI, the leader of this experiment, but I represent a collaboration of 200 people, most of them being scientists, but there are a number, obviously, of engineers. And the mission was actually dedicated to exoplanets. But the ability of this mission is so amazing that we could recycle it for doing dark matter searches. So you see basically the telescope in what would have been the shuttle where it would have been placed. This is the telescope itself. And what I wanted to say is that it does one thing very well. It looks in one direction, stare at it, and get enormous precision. So typically, this experiment, that's what we claim, at least, so you have to believe me. The precision we could have was basically if you put a cone in the surface of a moon, you would see its vibration. So this was amazing. And with that, we can see primordial black holes in the galactic center. So with that, we could have actually tell in this range, which is precisely the most interesting range, we could have said what is the fraction of primordial black holes there is in our galaxy. Unfortunately, we've not. The mission was proposed to ESA in a very tough competition. This is a mission of $500 million. So as you can imagine, it's a lot of politics. We've not been successful. We've been pretty far, but not to the end. But now we team up with a Japanese mission, which is called Small Jasmine. Small Jasmine actually look at the galaxy in infrared. So they're actually better than, to some extent, for primordial black holes. They can look in the galactic center, which with Theia was a little bit more difficult to do. And we hope that we can place some limits on the primordial black holes. So we don't know if Small Jasmine will go to, I mean, will be accepted, will fly, but it's very far now in the competition, so it's very likely to go. Yes?
So you are using astrometry?
Astrometry, yes, that's right.
But if your black holes are isolated, then how you can observe?
So we use astrometry and microlensing, so it's the two together. And we're mostly focusing on where they're supposed to be the most concentrated, so mostly the center in that case. Okay, so...
Can I just mention?
Yes, yes.
Myself and Wei-Li Pan wrote a paper ruling out this 30 solar mass black hole. Using the fact that, well, there's some assumptions which go into it.
Okay.
You have to ask, how did they form?
Yeah.
If they formed in the early universe, in the radiation,
yeah,
it requires very large amplitude perturbations on that scale, where delta rho over rho is about 0.2.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so what we showed is that those perturbations of radiation,
you see them,
would lead to shocks.
Right.
The shocks would emit gravitational waves, and they would already be seen in the European pulsar timing array. If the things work out, the scales are just right.
Yeah.
So that's already ruled out. Mm-hmm. The European pulsar timing array tells you that omega in gravitational waves on the corresponding wavelengths is less than 10 to minus 9.
Okay.
So the point is, we're already using gravitational waves to exclude violent phenomena. Mm-hmm. The early universe, such as would be required in this scenario. So Kamiakovsky et al. Also did a follow-up with.
Yes.
So there are other. I mean, this is still very worthwhile.
Yeah.
Worth doing.
Yeah, yeah.
So different.
Yeah.
But there are many.
But there are constraints. Yeah. Yes. Going in. Yeah.
Point. You know, many ways of exploring this hypothesis.
Yeah. Yeah, so actually, I mean, I mentioned this because after that I'm going to focus on particles, but I just wanted to make sure that people are aware that there are other possibilities, and I'm going now to assume that dark matter is made of particles. But of course, we may have a surprise eventually, and as you understood from the comment from Neil, it's fairly complicated. I think it's fair to say that it's the beginning of this kind of physics, really. There are many evidence for dark matter. I'm not going to spend too much time on this, I felt like I needed to mention that we use a lensing, and there is a very famous case, which is called the Bullet Cluster, where you have two clusters basically merging with each other. Now, what you expect from there is that you have gas in the cluster, and you have, if you believe me, you have some dark matter. Now, when they cross, you would expect the gas and the matter to interact with each other. So you expect a lot of gas emission. But in principle, if you have gas emission where the electrons are, you expect also that you would have all the gravitational potential base there. This is not what you see, because you have on top of the gas, you have some dark matter. And the gravitational potential is dominated actually by the dark matter. So what you see is that the gravitational potential is not anymore on the where the gas is actually far away, which tells you that somehow the dark matter cross didn't interact. And that's the main thing here, which is the point I will make later on. So here, the constraint you get from the Bullet Cluster is that you have what people said small interaction. Actually, astrophysicists call that almost collisionless. for a particle physicist is outrageous. A cross-section of 10 to minus 24 centimeters square, which is basically the Thomson cross-section, is huge. I mean, for me, it's huge. For anyone looking at Signal at LHC, it's huge. It's at least 15 orders of magnitude bigger than what you're looking for. So you can't neglect that. But at the time, people were saying, OK, this is a proof that the dark matter doesn't interact too much. And this is really particularly interesting because you can constrain the interaction with the gas, that's fine, but you can also constrain the interaction with itself, the dark matter with itself. And how do you do otherwise? How do you constrain the dark matter interaction with itself without using this kind of object? It's just impossible. So this was bringing an important information. In my mind, it's not going very far, but this was, at least this is a very good step towards. Now, the main evidence for me, and that's a critical point for me, the evidence for dark matter comes from here. Come from actually Jim Peebles in 67, who actually postulates, he was trying to understand how you can form galaxies. And it's true, how can you form galaxies, right? You have those huge objects which form while you're assuming that the universe started as a small object. So how can you form something like a galaxy when you have, you know, you don't have distances initially? So people try to explain with inflation and so on, but that doesn't explain the formation of galaxies themselves. So what Peebles was actually saying is that you could form galaxies if you have inhomogeneous regions in the universe which contain a little bit more matter than others. They would grow under gravity, and they would collapse, and they would form galaxies. But that was the main hypothesis in 67. 66, 67. So that is naively what you should keep in mind. Imagine you're the center of a universe. You look everywhere in all directions, so for you, you're the center. In some regions, you will see some regions which contain, in some direction, you will see some regions which contain a little bit more matter than others. And in some, you will see regions which contain less matter. Now, those will grow. The one which contain more matter will grow, and the one which contain less matter will become emptier. The thing which is important is that the energy density associated with radiation and matter is very well known. We know how it behaves with temperature. And so if you have a little more particles here, then you have a little bit more matter. So you have, basically, you can say what is the delta rho you get. And in fact, you can tell what is the delta rho of a rho that you should expect. Now, simple calculations show that whether you consider radiation or matter, the same, I mean, the delta rho of a rho that you get is related to the difference in temperature divided by the temperature. So if you see light, you see the fluctuation, the inhomogeneities in the universe. And that's what people have been looking for many years, starting in 1992. And eventually, the first amazing map was obtained by WMAP in 2003. Now, what you need to see in this picture really is that over the whole, basically in all directions, the temperature of the universe is about the same, 2.7 Kelvin, to make it rough. But you have small fluctuations, and those small fluctuations are extremely small, 10 to minus 5. But you see them. And they basically correspond to regions which are a little bit hotter or colder than the rest. So because you know where the light, how the light is distributed, you know how the matter is distributed. Now, when you have this, you can intuitively, I mean, because I'm not going to explain the whole physics, but I think it's very easy to understand that when you have such a map, such a detailed map, you first need to understand it with a mathematical description. And that mathematical description, because you can assimilate it to a sphere, is spherical harmonics. Now, if you had just the first spherical harmonics, you know that it would be constant, so you would describe the same temperature over the whole sky, which is what you get. But you would not describe inhomogeneities. To describe inhomogeneities, you need to go and explore the multiple, the higher multiple. Now, if you were using the multiple 1, you get the dipole, basically, and you see this feature, which is, you see it eventually, you have to remove it, but this is what you see here. It's far more detailed than this. So you understand that you need something which is more than just one multiple. You need actually, to describe this, you need to go up to 3,000, 4,000, multiples. So in other words, you need a huge amount of spherical harmonics to describe this map. Now, why do I mention this? Because the spherical harmonics give you a correlation, basically give you the size of the scale that you observe. So what you see in the sky is the regions with a given temperature. So you can basically count the regions that you have for a given scale. And you can report it in this plot. And this plot, for me, will be extremely important for the rest of the talk. What you see is that the first peak is related to inflation. Forget it for a moment. What you see is that you have all those patterns of oscillations. And what is really amazing, and that is one issue which will answer Lee, the problem here is that you see 8 peaks, if you count very carefully, and with an amazing precision. It's not like you have any uncertainty on that. You know where they are here. And what is more amazing is that they were predicted. So it's not that you discover and you try to explain something. You predicted it, you see it, and you see it with such precision. Now, the thing is, what is amazing is that now, if you try to do, until now, if you try to modify gravity and try to reproduce this plot, you will not manage. So nobody, to my knowledge, has managed to do that. And for me, that's why this is the evidence for dark matter. Because you can, with dark matter, all you need to do is you assume that you have a new species which is invisible, whatever it is, you don't need to say what it is, you don't need to say it's a particle, but you need to introduce it, and then you will reproduce this plot with this amazing degree of precision. If you had primordial black holes, in principle, you could do the same. So it's not really discriminating between particles and other objects. Now, the main point is that what you see in this plot is actually what we call the silk dumping. And silk has this, I mean, this is a very interesting paper, not so many people know. In fact, I'd like to make a point or so. If you look at this paper, which is the fundamental, I mean, this is the basics of all cosmology, it has only 85 or 89 citations. It's just, you know, that goes to show that sometimes you can have an extremely good idea and nobody knows it, basically, even though everybody knows that you have done fundamental work. Now, Joe, it's too good. It's too good to, for the time, basically. Yeah. Joe is in the same situation. Everybody knows the silk damping, but nobody really knows his fundamental paper, which was in, he prepared it in 66 and published it in 67. He was a PhD student, so that gives a lot of hope, I give hope. But basically what he realized is that he was aware of Pieber's work, but he was also aware of another work from Misner. And Misner was saying, well, if you have fluctuations, and there must be neutrinos in them, if you have those fluctuations with neutrinos, there would be some dissipation because neutrinos interact with electrons. Misner got the idea right, but he got the particle wrong because the neutrino-electron interaction is super small. It's very suppressed, so it doesn't, I mean, the dissipation is negligible. But Joe realized that actually the idea is so good that if you now forget about neutrinos, but you take the photon, you have photon-electron interaction. That's huge interaction because this is a Thomson cross-section. And therefore, you have a lot of dissipation. And you are going to have a problem with a fluctuation because you create so much dissipation that you will never see, you will never be able to form fluctuation of small scales. And so with this argument, what you should predict when you look at this plot is that if the universe is only made of baryons, if there is nothing else, you should see the red curve, basically. Forget this part, but you should see a first peak, but then a second peak would be suppressed, and then you will not be able to do the third and fourth and five peaks, and so on. And yet we see them. So there must be something else. And what you say is basically, well, there are baryons. We know that we are made of baryons. And for cosmologists, baryons means electrons, so don't be shocked. But we know that we are made of ordinary matter, but there must be something else, and this something else must not interact with photons. So then you think, well, it must be something which is neutral, hence the dark matter. So it's all compatible, but this is, for me, the most elegant explanation, I mean, the most elegant argument to say there must be something which doesn't interact with photons in a certain way, not as, at least not as strongly as the baryons. And what you see in this plot is essentially some oscillations which can be described by Bessel functions. This is not my point. What I wanted to show you here is mostly that you're not at the scale of galaxies yet, and if you continue to reach a galaxy scale, you need actually a new description which would involve Fourier modes. So this is what we now call the matter power spectrum. This is a distribution of light, this is a distribution of matter. And those two, for me, are going to be fundamental for the rest of the discussion. So this is the same, more or less the same information, how matter or light is distributed across the sky. One is in Fourier and the other one is in spherical harmonics. Now, here is what I wanted to discuss. So the topic is about light dark matter, but it's time from one naive question. If you have some dark matter, to get this plot, you have basically made the strong assumption that there is no interaction. So you have, you didn't say anything if it's a particle or not, but you assume that if it is a particle, there is no dissipation, because otherwise you're scared of having the seal damping. But then when you look for the dark matter in any experiment, you look for it. So you hope that it's interacting. It should be interacting with you, with your detector. Otherwise, you can't see it. So on one hand, cosmology tells, well, forget it. Yeah, there's no interaction. On the other hand, every single experiment in particle physics will tell you, well, there must be an interaction if you want to see it. So the question is, are they compatible? I mean, they're obviously a set of assumptions which are not compatible. But is the result compatible? And what I can tell you straight away is that depending on the strength of interaction, this map will not be correct. If dark matter interacts as a baryon, then we know that we would have a huge seal damping effect. So we will not reproduce the small scales, and we will not see all those little patterns. Just straight away, I know that if dark matter interacts very strongly, it will not reproduce, I will never reproduce what I've seen. So I can already exclude this straight away. But of course, you have to do it more carefully. Now, when you say, well, the dark matter has interactions, you have to specify with what. So first of all, by interaction, in principle, you could mean elastic scattering, annihilation, whatever you think about. I will focus on elastic scattering, and you will understand why. But then you have to say, well, if I have dark matter particle, let's say, then it can interact with standard model. Why not? Could it interact with photons, providing that it's not interacting with photon in the same way as with the baryons. It should be fine. And then it can interact with itself, or it can interact with a dark sector. And I have no mean to know if it interacts if I don't test it. So the cosmologist starts with one assumption: dark matter doesn't interact. And I will go against this by saying I'm going to actually assume that the dark matter interacts, and I will let the data tell me how much it can interact. The data should tell me it cannot interact too much, but I should find that eventually. I should do the exercise and recover this. So this is a little bit technical, but if you want to understand what is the effect of the dark matter interactions, you have to understand the way the physics goes. So the dark matter interaction are basically collisions. So you have a diffusion length. And then eventually the dark matter, because the universe expands, eventually the interaction will stop. The universe will be so big that the particles won't see each other and won't be able to interact with each other. So that moment is called decoupling. In fact, it's called kinetic decoupling. And then eventually the universe continues to live and the dark matter is free to propagate. Now, on this on this line, you see TNR and TEG. Those are referring to two specific times: the moment where the dark matter becomes non-relativistic, and the moment where the matter becomes dominant over the radiation. Now, those three times are here represented in this order, and I could have changed the order because I don't know what is the dark matter. So I could have the dark matter decoupling first, becoming non-relativistic, and then eventually, the universe is dominated by matter. Or I could have imagined that the dark matter interacts continue to interact even after the universe became dominated by matter. So I have three times, six permutations, and I can look at all those six cases. When the dark matter has interacted and stopped interacting, then we say it's free streaming. This is this case here. When the dark matter interacts, the dissipation that you get is called collisional damping. I basically coined this word, but everybody, I think, speaking about the same thing now, about the same name. So you have first a collision, and then you have a free streaming. That part is very easy to compute because you basically say that the dark matter is free to propagate. So you just have to integrate. It's just depending on the dark matter velocity. This part is a little bit more complicated because you have to say with what it interacts and how it interacts. But this part is very similar to the seal damping. So, and we have a good knowledge of the seal damping. So when I first worked on this, I was very naive, and I worked with someone fantastic who is called Richard Schaeffer. I think, Neil, you met him perhaps once. And he basically told me, this idea is not going to work, but I see you stubborn, so I'm going to work with you. And it was great because I would have not been able to describe actually all the physics without his help. But together we came up, we didn't know enough basically. We didn't know all the formalism that people are using now that I'm using also myself now. So we came up with this formula, which is very simple. We just say, well, you have a mean free path when you have collisions, and then you have to integrate during all the time where the dark matter interacts. So you have an integral here. And then it depends if you have dark matter interaction with baryons, with photons, etc. They don't have the same density. So somehow you need to reflect for the fact that you have different density. You have maybe more photons than, you have more photons than baryons, and so on. So somehow you need this ratio of rho I divided by rho total, which is rho I being the particle with which the dark matter interacts. Very simple formula, but it works out. Now we can check it with a much more sophisticated formalism, and I know this is correct. So the physics is first you have a collision, you erase some fluctuations because of a collision, because of a diffusion, and then eventually stop, and then you have the free streaming. And that continues to erase the fluctuations which you had left. So, sorry.
There's a cross-section of interaction.
There, I don't need to specify it. I just need to actually assume, and then I can see I can find basically using the observation, using the scale, I can find what is the maximal cross-section that is allowed by the data.
So that's a free part.
I will show you in a few minutes. I'm not going to go into the detail of the collisions, but I will show you the results. Now I'm just going to focus on the free streaming for a short time. What you get, and this was actually the beginning of light dark matter for me, is what you get, because you have six ways of organizing the candidates, the dark matter candidates, so you get a plot, which is basically the strength of interaction versus the dark matter mass. Everything here is excluded because you would not reproduce small galaxies. So any particle which is lighter than a few keV and has no interaction cannot reproduce all the galaxies we've seen. So forget about it. You need, if dark matter is made of particles and doesn't have any interaction, it needs to be heavier than a few keV. That's the first information you learn that everybody knew before me. But then what we realize is because we assume that the dark matter can have interaction, it's not the only case. You can have more cases. And what you see here is a case where you can have a particle between keV and MeV with non-negligible interaction. They're not super strong, but they're non-negligible. And what you see is that if you're living on this line, you have a candidate which erase small galaxies, which prevent the formation of small galaxies, but allow everything else. So technically, this candidate is allowed, but you can see that it is very light in between keV and MeV. And it has interactions, not very big, but it has interaction. And then you have this part which corresponds to very large interactions. And this is the region that a lot of people are looking at the moment for self-interaction. Now, the point from this diagram is that you can have some particles which are between keV and MeV, so you have light dark matter. In principle, just using this cosmology argument, you can have light dark matter. But can you really have it? And then it depends some assumption, which is how the dark matter was produced initially in the universe. So for this, I'm mentioning thermal, but you can forget for now. The point I wanted to say is that for this kind of candidate, in principle, you cannot have light dark matter. Because there was a very famous limit, which is called Hüth, Lee and Weinberg. So Lee and Weinberg did a paper just after Hüth. Everybody knows the paper by Lee and Weinberg. Not so many people know the paper of Hüth, but they were basically more or less at the same time. And they were making exactly the same argument, which is, in principle, you can describe the number, the evolution of number of particles in the universe, including the number density of dark matter. This is a simple Boltzmann equation. You don't need to say what kind of particle it is. You don't need to say mention the interaction, mention the mass. You can solve this equation because it's basically thermodynamics in an expanding universe. And when you solve it, you obtain that the dark matter density you have today, or any abundance today, is inversely proportional to the annihilation cross-section. And this really makes sense. If you have a particle which annihilates a lot, you won't have any more particles left. If the annihilation cross-section is very small, you would have too much dark matter left. So it's really clear. But the thing is, we have measured this, the abundance of dark matter today, with extreme precision, 1%. So we know what is the annihilation cross-section. So if dark matter annihilates, we know what is the probability to have this annihilation cross-section to be such that you have exactly the abundance that we observe. And this is this value. Okay. Now, this corresponds to 3×10⁻³⁶ centimeters square, so it's basically 1 picobarn, and this is what we would call weak interactions. The point is, what Lee Weinberg were really saying is that now that you have this value, any models where you have an annihilation cross-section, you would see that for them, the annihilation cross-section would be proportional to the dark matter mass, and so when you impose that this is equal to this, you found actually a value of a dark matter mass. At the time, they didn't know what is the exact annihilation cross-section because it was not measured with this level of precision. But you can see that if a dark matter is too light, then the annihilation cross-section is going to be too large and you won't have enough dark matter and so on. So with this, they knew that the dark matter had to be heavier than a few GeV. So they concluded that the dark matter must be heavier than a proton. But I told you that I wanted to have particles in between a few keV and a few mEV. So can you do it? And I found some exceptions, which are very simple, at least for a particle physicist. If you have an annihilation, you shouldn't have an annihilation cross-section which is proportional to the dark matter mass square, because otherwise you have an issue. But if you find those kind of interactions where the dark matter is a scalar annihilating into fermions, through a heavy mediator, which is a fermion in this case, then you have this annihilation cross-section here. What you see here is basically you have a cross-section which depends on the mass of a final state and the mass of a mediator. The CL and CR correspond to the couplings of a dark matter to the left and right component of a fermion, of a model, in that case, of a standard model. Now, imagine that this product is not zero. And imagine that dark matter annihilates into a particle which is very light. Then in this case, you have an annihilation cross-section, which is essentially proportional to this term, basically the mass of a mediator to the square. So inversely proportional to the mass of a mediator. Why do I mention this? Because from there, you realize you can do light dark matter. If you look at this cross-section, nowhere you see an information about the dark matter mass. This cross-section is independent of a dark matter mass. If it's independent of a dark matter mass, it doesn't matter whether the dark matter is light or heavy, you can do the right Rydberg density. And if you can do the right Rydberg density, then you can have, again, you can have anything you want, it's fine. So for this particular range, particular type of interaction, you can say that you can have light dark matter in between keV and mEV range. Now, there is another type of interactions which people are looking now, which is the exchange of a new mediator, a new vector mediator called Z prime. In this case, the cross-section is proportional to the dark matter mass, so it's bad news. However, the mediator can compensate for this dependence. So you can have a light mediator and light dark matter, and then it's all fine. So if you look at this plot, this is completely obsolete. You can have light dark matter. You can use the Rydberg density, it can explain the abundance you see today, but you can have particles lighter than a few GeV. So this was particularly exciting at the time. So this was mostly in 2001 or something, 2002. And then 2003 came something extremely exciting for me, because this was the observation that you have a huge amount of positrons in the galactic center. Now, we believe that electron and positron annihilate, we know that. This has been measured with a lot of precision, so we know it happens. But we believe that the interaction is so strong that, in principle, there shouldn't be any positrons left in the galaxy. However, you have astrophysical sources which do produce the positrons. So, in principle, in the galaxy, you should have some antimatter, but you don't expect to have a lot of antimatter. And now what was discovered in 2003, there were evidence, a large number of evidence before, but this was the first map, the first precise map of a positron in our galaxy. And what you see is that it's mostly centered on the galactic center. So there is a huge amount of positron in the galactic center, which means there is a huge amount of antimatter in the galactic center. Now the galactic center also contains electrons. So you should have annihilations, and you do. This is the way you observe them. You observe either the production of a line, if you have a plus or minus into 2 gamma or a continuum. And this experiment, I mean, this mission called SPI on board of a satellite called Integral observe exactly the both the 511 keV and the continuum. That's what they saw. Now, why is it important? Well, the thing is, there's so many positrons in the galaxy, in the center of a galaxy, that we have absolutely no clue what is responsible for their creation. So we see them, and we don't know where they come from. We don't know what is generating them. It could be astrophysical sources, and a lot of people were advocating that, but then we should see them all over the galactic disk, and this is not the case. You see that most of emission come from the center. And the spherical center, I mean, the spherical emission is basically compatible with dark matter. So this was very exciting at the time because I was doing MEV dark matter. If you have MEV dark matter, then it can annihilate and produce electron and positrons. The electron and positron can annihilate and form this signal. And this was extremely straightforward because all the calculations were done. We took the model which I had before, we computed the signal, and this was completely compatible. So this was a very big hope, and we had even a paper called "Has MEV dark matter been observed?" And of course, you know this is not true, but it was very exciting because there was really this match which you cannot reproduce nowadays with astrophysical sources. Now, I would say you may think, "Oh well, this is particle physicists getting excited because they don't know anything about astrophysics." It's partly true, but. The signal is still to be explained nowadays. It's still impossible for so far to explain it with the astrophysical sources that we know. We don't understand there is a huge amount of antimatter in the galactic center. It's for this, what I should say is for this to happen, the positrons need to be at rest. This galactic center is not a place where you stay at rest. There's a lot of wind, there's a lot of thing. I guess we have experts here. So it's really bizarre that you have a lot of positrons, lots of antimatter, basically at rest in the galactic center. And there is no good model. Perhaps the best that we have at the moment is low-mass X-ray binaries. Maybe now we can say it's neutron stars or something like this, but so far there is a real problem, which is why don't you see anything in the disk? So the model was working very well. I was deducing that this could explain the 511 keV line, and then this needed to be... basically was needed, sorry, this, what have I done? I made a mistake. This was needed for the 511 keV line, and this was needed for the relic density. It doesn't matter because at the same time you could say, well, do you really have to annihilate into electrons? You could also annihilate into neutrinos. And then a second surprise came, which is that basically if you assume that, if you take this model and you assume that the dark matter can annihilate into neutrinos, you actually found a link, very amazing link between the neutrino mass and the dark matter annihilation cross section. And this is very amazing. I mean, there is no free parameters there. You put, you know, what you know from the relic density, which is imposed by the CMB measurement, and you get the right mass for the neutrino, which has been, I mean, at least the right limit for the mass of the neutrino. So it's very, I mean, it was very weird. You have this model which does a lot of things, really very interesting. But then now to come back, I have this strange particle physics model which does a lot of things, but can you really observe it concretely? And now I have to go back to the collisional damping effect because if you believe this model, then you have a modification of a CMB. Tiny modification is not in a place where we can really see things, but it does imply that the distribution of matter across the sky is different. What you see here, so the power spectrum I showed you before should be here. What you see here is those oscillations. If the matter was distributed with such oscillation, we would have seen it already. So we know it doesn't work. So we can rule out very large cross-section. But basically, we can rule out the cross-section until here, and here it's okay. And that corresponds to a cross-section which is about 10 to minus 36 centimeters square for a particle of 1 MeV. And that's a weak interaction. So this is exactly what I was considering, and this is exactly what gives a suppression of the power in the matter power spectrum. Now, those oscillations now have been called the dark oscillation. They're easy to understand. They're basically the fight, they reflect the fight between the pressure and the gravity, the pressure from the dark matter interactions and the gravity which tried to basically collapse the fluctuations. So what is interesting in this model is that not only does connection with neutrino, not only could explain the 511 keV line, but on top of that, it changes the age of the universe in a way that is a little bit more compatible with the later measurements. It also changes the number of structures at 8 megaparsec, where we think it actually predicts less structure than we observe, sorry, less structure than lambda CDM, and this is actually closer to the observation. So globally, it seems like you have a better, you have a good model, basically. A long time ago, a few years ago, I thought we were changing the number degree of freedom, and that's actually not true. But so I wanted to, I know that I'm going to be over time, so I'm just going to finish very close to that. But I wanted to show you what is the result of a structure formation, and this is in particular for the Milky Way. So if you believe in this model, here is a prediction. This is what the Milky Way should look like. So first we start with the Milky Way in what we call the lambda CDM model, so no interactions. We zoomed in the center of the Milky Way. You see lots of little objects. And those are basically what we call dwarf galaxies. And then now when you have dark matter interaction, you don't see all those little objects. Many have disappeared. So in a model where you have interaction, you have a bit of, you have small galaxies, but you don't have a huge amount. But if the interactions are too large, this is what you get. And now, basically, you don't see any more small structures. So you have no more small galaxies. And that's not possible because we have seen small galaxies in the Milky Way. So this is completely ruled out. So using this, using this model and trying to make the prediction, you can see that you get a strong constraint, which is, you cannot have too large interaction, otherwise you do not reproduce the Milky Way where we live. So in other words, the summary is that we could, basically using this model, we could say how, even though we don't observe it, we could say how it must interact with the visible matter. We know that it cannot interact too much. We can say what is the maximum cross-section. So the last point I wanted to make is that because you suppress the number of objects, but you did see a few, you saw basically what is in this part and what is this part is compatible with observation, you can make a prediction of what you the kind of 511 keV signal you expect in these small objects. And so you have many of those small objects, and some are called, a few are very, very small. So there is reticulum 2, hologium, Eridanus, and so on. You can make the prediction of 511 keV you expect in those parts. And this is a prediction here. We have analyzed this map. We have data for all of them. We have found only one object, which is called a dwarf galaxy. There is only one object in which we have a 511 keV signal. This is reticulum 2. This is a very particular one, and I don't think we have a signal from reticulum 2. I think we have a signal from behind reticulum 2, probably. But what is amazing is that, strangely enough, by pursuing a pure particle physics, first a cosmological question, which is, can we have collisional dark matter? And then pursuing a specific model, we end up doing pure astrophysics, but discovering actually potential signals in dwarf galaxies, which are companions of the Milky Way. So, did we discover dark matter? No, There are plenty of limits now. A lot of people took this work seriously, fortunately. Experimentalists have done a fantastic job. So when I introduced the new interaction with the gauge boson, there was no constraint, basically. The only one which was known was it's called the J-2 of the electron and the muon, so the anomalous magnetic moment. The constraint was somewhere here, and I had all the parameter space for myself. Nobody was interested in doing this, so this was fantastic. I was exploring. And then 2 years later, all the limits came. All the experimentalists worked on this. Not all, but many. A lot of people, a lot of theoreticians started to think about out of the box, things related to this model, but not the way I conceived it. And that led to all the limits that you see here. And in fact, when you look at this, plane, it's almost like everything is excluded. But what is amazing in this is that we have explored, for one perhaps wrong reason, but we have explored a huge amount of parameter space nonetheless. We have explored basically couplings which were extremely small. It goes down to 10 to minus 10. This is basically the coupling. This is the mass of a boson. And you can see that actually pursuing an idea which may be completely wrong, we have actually explored new ideas that I didn't necessarily think about and not other people have thought about initially. But actually now together, we're actually providing amazing way to probe the dark matter parameter space. I can continue like this. There are plenty of limits. So basically everything I thought about has been, I would say, sometimes people think I exaggerate, but for me, I would say kind of excluded. I'm exaggerating a bit because there's still a bit of room, but it's tough. So all these ideas I exposed to you, they've been tested. They've been not necessarily completely excluded, but certainly constrained, very constrained. By many ways, this is by using BBN. This was using LHC physics and so on and so on. And so what I wanted to just conclude is that I'm very proud of this work in the sense that it started with one simple question. Can we have dark matter? Can we have collisions? Can dark matter interact? And then through that, you see that you make a relation to the neutrino masses. You make a relation to the antimatter in the universe. Through that, you make a relation with the new type of interaction, the new forces in the universe. You kind of ruled everything out, unfortunately, because it seems like it's hard to discover new physics nowadays, but the main thing is that I think we have something interesting, which is this work led us to explore one particular object, reticulum 2, found a signal from there, which may be a 511 keV signal, which would mean that in that direction, if it's not in that object, you have a huge amount of positrons produced. Now, this is weird if you don't realize it, because a dwarf galaxy doesn't contain a lot of gas. It's almost empty. It's basically dark matter dominated. How can you have a huge amount of positron, a huge amount of antimatter, in a place where you're not supposed to have any gas? So that's another issue. And I think if we confirm that, we will actually have data very soon. But when we confirm that, if we confirm that, then I think we will make a connection with what happened in the galactic center. And this is for sure going to give something very interesting, whether it's going to reveal a new type of sources which we didn't expect in the galactic center, or whether it tells us something actually about dark matter, I do not know. But I just wanted to present this path of how we start. I mean, I started with one idea and how we end up with something completely different, but which may be actually much more interesting. Thank you.
Sky, do you include light from galaxies and stars, or are those filtered out?
So I didn't hear the last part.
Do you include light from galaxies and stars, or do you filter that out in microwave background?
Yeah, so for the cosmic microwave background, you remove, you subtract the emission from the galaxy itself, because you think you know it at least.
Okay, so why do you talk, why do you relate the fluctuations in the CMB with the fact that the more mass you have, the more it gets clumped and something like that?
Sorry, just go back there. Was it here? So what I was saying is that this is without the galaxy, without the light from the galaxy, this is what you get from the whole universe, right? This is really your background. Your photons from the Big Bang. And what you see here is basically the fact that you observe those two, three peaks. In fact, it's the ratio of the second and third peak, which really tells you that there is something else than the baryons. The reason is, if you have baryons, if the universe was dominated by baryons, you would not see the second and third and fourth and fifth peak. You would see the red curve. That's not what we've seen. So you need something. You need to add something in the universe that doesn't dissipate like the baryons.
Okay. So you filter out the light from the baryons, and then you attribute the fluctuations to dark matter you can't see?
So it's more complicated. You remove the first light that you get is from the galaxy is the light coming from the stars. You remove that.
Okay.
Because you don't want to see stars. They're not fundamental, right?
Yeah.
You still see some light, which is fundamental, which is emitted by the electrons in the past, in the early universe.
Yeah.
And because it was electron interacting with photons, you see some patterns, which is basically the pattern that you see here. But if you had only electrons, you wouldn't see that specific pattern, you would see the red one. And the fact that you see something more complicated than just the red one tells you that you have not just electrons at the time. In the early universe, you also had something else which was not interacting with the photons and would change the gravitational potential. Yes, it's clear now?
Have you at any point in your research looked at dark energy as well, or is it always completely unrelated with dark matter?
Yeah, so some people are trying to relate the two, because from basically at some stage when you do dark matter interaction, you may say, well, dark matter interacts with a substance which you don't necessarily see. It could be some kind of dark sector, and then that could be related to dark energy. So a lot of people are doing this. I didn't do it personally, but people are doing it. And then what you see is that you have a modification of this part of the spectrum, and then you have to ask yourself whether this is exactly the dark matter interaction with this dark sector, or whether this is a modification of gravity, or whether this is due to another effect.
More questions?
Yep. There is no students.
Yeah, it's fine.
And in your last slide, you have a map from the positron interaction.
Yep.
Last.
Which one do you want? Sorry.
The latest. Yeah, that's one. So this one is the positron interaction with the electron.
This is basically the map. I mean, here, if you want, that's what you expect from electron-positron annihilation.
Yes. There are some clumps at this parallel arm also. You have three at the left side.
Here, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not necessarily related. I mean, there is also some background here, so you should really look. The green is not important. You should really look at the red.
If they're the red light, red spots are the left side of that galactic bulge. So that you have the galactic bulge. So this coordinate is the galactic, is it right?
Yes.
So at the center you have the bulge, and the left side you have three spots, three.
Yeah, but it's a bit. Because you have a disk, you have to subtract. I didn't show you what is the residual.
Yeah, I mean, if the positron are coming also from this parallel arm.
Yes.
Then
I see what you mean. You want to see the disk.
It's astrophysical source.
No, so the disk is very faint. I mean, I forget about this map. If I was showing you the map that you see really from focusing on the galactic center, you would see the galactic center is super bright. And then the disk is super faint. And there is about, I hope I'm not saying something wrong, but I think there is a factor 1,000 in between the emission.
You don't have any signal from the disk?
From the disk, it's very, very small. They found it eventually, but it's very, very faint. So it's mostly located in the bulge. And that's why it's so bizarre. You have a huge amount, it's really huge. You have a huge, it's 10 to 42, I mean, it's a huge amount of positrons. And it's really located in the galactic center. And you really don't expect that, because most of astrophysical sources, they diffuse out in the disk. So you should see the disk very prominently. You don't see that.
They just discovered a new big black hole in the center of the Milky Way. Is that possibly relevant?
So I don't know, because initially the people who made the estimate for black hole, they said that basically. So I've forgotten the argument, but basically it was not a good source. I think it was because it was not...
The standard one is not, but the new one seems to be
okay.
Gas.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if you can say that you excite or you produce a jet, maybe that would work. Yeah. But it is, again, you have to explain why it would be confined in the bulge and not going, because the distance can go very far. So you have an issue about propagation. So it's a complicated... I mean, it's not just a small estimate. So perhaps, I mean, there is something to understand for sure.
In most talks that I've heard on dark matter, they focus on all of dark matter being made up of one component, like dark matter, black holes, or primordial black holes. Is there an argument for that hypothesis that it should be one component, not more complicated? I understand that more complicated models more complicated, but Is there an argument for why it should be warm comparable?
Very strong argument.
No, I mean, there was one motivation. So you're right, in principle, you can have plenty of particles. There is one. There is one argument which was in favor, and historically it was the one used. Is if you want the dark matter has to be stable, and generally the way you do this is by preventing the particle to decay. So this means that generally you have a symmetry which prevents the decay, and so for example in supersymmetry you had that naturally once you impose R parity, the lightest particle of a supersymmetric spectrum would be completely stable and would be your dark matter candidate. All the others, they would decay, and they would decay too fast to be the dark matter. So it is very possible that you have a very complicated dark sector, I mean, with lots of particles that you've never seen, but most of them would decay. And so unless you have several symmetries or unless you have a theory which predicts several stable particles, then you prefer the case where you have one particle.
But again, like a mixture of black holes and a dark.
Yes, yes. Yeah, you could have that. You could also, people manage to have, for example, two dark matter candidates stable. I mean, I've done that, a lot of people have done that, where you assume two dark matter particles, but then you could say, why not three, why not four, and so on. So you can do it. But as you say, after, so you lose. A lot of people were motivated by the fact that if dark matter has been produced in the early universe, in a thermal way, then you can use a relic density calculation, as I show by Hulde and Weinberg, and you can make a very simple prediction. If you start with many more candidates, how much do you know? I mean, you know, you can have candidate one with 20% of a relic density, candidate two with 40, but how do you know that, you know? So that's also why people don't play this game too much, because you really lose the predictability. And then from the theory side, you don't really have, I mean, you have to impose many more symmetries. So it's not the most elegant, but perhaps it's the right answer. We don't know.
OK, so I suggest you bring up new dark matter ideas either over the snacks, which are downstairs, or to Celine in her office. And she will be around until end of September, and then again later for 2 months.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.